Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. DeSantis decries the weaponization of government as Trump is indicted for a third time. The governor keeps fading in the polls amid signs his culture war approach is falling flat. And the firestorm continues over Florida's new Black History standards. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson. And those are some of the stories I'll be discussing today with Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy and Palm Beach Post political editor Antonio Finns. But first, well, we're back in business here at Inside Florida Politics after taking nearly the entire month of July off. And of course, there was lots of stuff that happened in July while we were gone. We have the DeSantis reboot. We have the third Trump indictment. Lots of stuff to talk about, but we'll go with some numbers here first. John, the number that's in my head lately has been the temperature. It's been pretty warm. How are you doing up there in Tallahassee?
Oh, yeah. This is basically the same temperature as the planet Venus, but we're enduring. We're enjoying the summer, nonetheless. But I do have a number of a political nature, and it's a 23 this week.
23. All right. How about you, Antonio?
Well, to welcome the NFL preseason this evening, I was looking for a football-related number, but I'm just going to go with politics, 33.
Okay, and I have a 6 this week. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll let you know what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, another bombshell indictment dropped this week as Trump now faces 4 charges related to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The charges may be new, but the reaction from DeSantis was largely the same as he criticized what he described as the weaponization of government and a political prosecution. Antonio, there's really a lot to dissect here. What's your take on how this third indictment is playing politically?
Yeah, but you know what, Zach, let's go back a bit to a year ago this coming Tuesday. And it was another sweltering August evening in Palm Beach. And we were wrapping up the workday when former President Trump stunningly announced that his Palm Beach County Club, Mar-a-Lago, was the site of an FBI raid. In the past 12 months since that evening, man, it's been equally stunning to see how legal and political fortunes have turned in opposite directions. We have never had a former president and presidential candidate beset by as many charges, close to 80 felonies at this point, and they are related to a hush money payment to a porn star, waving classified secret documents to guests, and leading an effort to end 247 years of American democracy. At the same time, Mr. Trump remains the most popular candidate in the Republican Party. And if polls are correct, and we have no reason to think that every one of those polls is wrong, well, he is on his way to the GOP nomination next year. So you look at that and you think, wow, just wow.
I saw one analysis, Antonio, that at this point in the race, if a front runner was winning by at least 20 points in the polls, they had never lost. And Trump, in this latest New York Times poll, is leading by like 37 points. So that's pretty bad news for DeSantis.
Yeah, but if you think back even to the end of this of last year, in December of last year, I mean, Trump seemed to be a fading star on the GOP landscape. But in the first half of this year, as the felonies piled up, he's had this remarkable rebound in popularity among Republican Party faithful. Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis, who the New York Post crowned the future back in November of last year, seems to be the one fading and plummeting. And a key reason why fortunes have turned almost 180 degrees is because GOP voters, according to polls, have rallied around Trump even as his legal troubles have mushroomed since the spring. What we have heard for many months now is that these charges, almost, like I said, almost 80 felony counts at this point, have been seen by the GOP rank and file as renewed evidence of a government out of control. GOP voters in Trump MAGA rank and file, have told us as much. However, if you read the indictments, it appears to be Mr. Trump who's acting out of control and with no regard for guardrails. Which view is true? Well, that's up to judges and the juries to sort out. What we can say is that the MAGA establishment is organized and lockstep on talking points. After each indictment, including Tuesday's 4 counts related to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, after each one of those, the GOP falls in line behind Trump with talking points, noting that this is political interference, that it's weaponized government, and it's uneven treatment by the justice system, especially they say when compared to, you know, let's say, you know, President Joe Biden's son Hunter and
Antonio, his legal woes. Yeah. What one leading Republican who wasn't on those talking points this week was Mike Pence. I mean, Mike Pence came out with a really strong statement saying, you know, Trump asked me to choose between the Constitution and him, and I'll choose the Constitution every time. He called Trump's lawyers a bunch of crackpots. Very different than what DeSantis is saying. Will Hurd, another Republican presidential candidate, is basically saying that Trump is running for president just to stay out of prison, not really to win, and that this is all a legal strategy. I mean, there are some leading Republicans who are being much more forceful in what they're saying about Trump and these indictments and his culpability. You don't hear that really from DeSantis at all.
No, you don't. And you know, quite frankly, Pence and Hurd and the others, you know, Asa Hutchinson and Chris Christie, they're all in the low single digits. Pence has moved up a little bit. So basically, yeah, you speak truth to power, but you know, the MAGA faithful does not want to hear any of that. And there is an entire media machine that is ramped up to reinforce, you know, what the prevailing, you know, Trump viewpoint is and the party line, so to speak. So now, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if as Pence becomes much more vocal on this, does the never Trumper vote, do they all of a sudden start switching sides away from the Chris Christies, you know, all these single digits and pile up?
That's what I wonder, Antonio. Not necessarily like who is winning the Trump vote, because I mean the MAGA base, Trump obviously has that locked up, but there's still, you know, maybe upwards of 50% of the party, I don't know, that is not for Trump, and maybe they do want to hear some of this stuff. Maybe DeSantis has miscalculated in just going after the MAGA base, and that maybe somebody like Tim Scott or Nikki Haley or Pence or ends up emerging here as somebody who stands out by being more independent from Trump.
Well, yeah. And that's I think what, if you're the Ken Griffins of the world, if you're the Thomas Petterfees, if you're looking at these big donors, the Club for Growth, the all of these conservative organizations and, you know, sort of quote unquote, never Trump Republicans, that's your hope right now, is that everybody can coalesce behind one of these candidates. And then, you know, that candidate now commands attention, commands a sizable support, and then ultimately starts siphoning away voters from Trump, GOP voters from Trump, because of the who can win, you know, debate. As in other words, they say, you know what, I really do like Trump, but we need to win, and a Tim Scott might have a better shot of winning in November of 2024. The weird thing, though, and this is what I would throw as a caution out there, is that I've heard from a number of rank and file Trump-loving, you know, Trumplicans. They don't even call themselves Republicans. They're Trumplicans. They're, you know, they're MAGA, whatever. And their response to the who can win argument is Trump is the one that can win because Trump won in 2020 and they stole it from him. They're not going to steal it from him this time. So that's the one, you know, if you're a Tim Scott, to get over, or Mike Pence, to get over the finish line here in about a year, in August of, to become the presumptive nominee sometime late spring of next year, you not only have to coalesce the part of the party that doesn't care for Trump, you also have to win over Trump faithful. And a lot of them, I've heard, well, I can't say I heard from a lot, but I've heard from a number of them who make that argument. No, Trump is the one that can beat Biden because he's already done it. And that's going to be a really tough sell.
I don't know. I don't know how much of the Trump faithful you can really convert over. That seems to be DeSantis's theory of the case, that there's a lot of Trump faithful that are willing to break with him. And I'm just not sure about that. I think there's just a group of Republicans who don't like Trump, and there's a group of Republicans who really like Trump. But there's also a group in the middle who they kind of like him, but they're ready to move on. They're open to moving on, at least. And I think those are the people that DeSantis is failing to get in large numbers right now. But.
And there is. We know there is, even within the Trump faithful, the hardcore Trump audience, there is a subset that says, I love this guy. I will always love this guy, but I really want to win. And if I can find somebody who makes the same arguments he makes on these cultural issues, I'm willing to back that candidate, because we got to win in 2024. Yeah. The question is, how do you win that crowd over? And I'm not sure.
Well, it's definitely not looking like DeSantis is doing it right now. And the evidence that his campaign is really going nowhere fast keeps piling up. Since our last podcast, the governor had to reboot again, cutting more than 40% of his campaign staff amid concerns he was burning through cash much too quickly. He's tried to change his messaging approach, interacting more with the mainstream media, who he used to just utterly lambast and ignore. DeSantis 2.0 still looks a lot like the original, though, and he's still leaning hard on his war on woke. Just this week, he rolled out an economic plan that was heavy on criticizing woke corporations, even as a New York Times Siena poll found that 52% of GOP voters prefer a candidate who steers clear of telling corporations what they can support over one who promises to, quote, fight woke liberal corporate ideology. Of course, fighting woke corporate ideology is DeSantis's bread and butter. Just ask Disney. John, that same New York Times poll, as I mentioned earlier, has DeSantis at just 17% support compared to 54% support for Trump. It doesn't really seem like the reboot is helping, if you can call it a reboot.
Yeah, you know, a reboot is an acknowledgement that something isn't working. And for DeSantis, it seems like it's most of his campaign right now. He's still got a lot of money in the Never Back Down pack that's allied with this.
Yeah,
campaign.
Almost $100 million. You really can't discount that. That could get him at least to the early nominating states.
Yeah. I mean, he's still far ahead of anyone else in the field, including Trump, when it comes to PAC money. But he's been spending a lot, and his push to change messaging seems forced. And as both of you pointed out a moment ago, it doesn't seem to be working. You know, he's making a pitch for those blue collar voters now, which Trump isn't giving up. And there are serious signs now that maybe he doesn't even make it to Iowa in January in the first nominating contest on the Republican calendar. But, you know, he does have the money to kind of soldier on for now. So maybe that's a little bit of a long shot that he doesn't make it. But he's not really going in that direction very, very vigorously right now.
Yeah, I don't see him giving up before Iowa, John. I think he'll at least go to Iowa. And if he doesn't, you know, get first or second there, then it's probably over. But that's my just hunch.
Sure. Yeah. And he's invested heavily in Iowa. There's no doubt about that, with a lot of staff on the ground. And, you know, he's working the caucuses, trying to set that up in a way, which, you know, is kind of an intriguing element of the Iowa caucus. The anti-woke stuff, which DeSantis has made his brand, you know, that doesn't seem to be captivating that many Republican voters. You know, Ed Rollins, the longtime Republican consultant who recently left the DeSantis super PAC, called him, the quote, not a natural candidate, unfortunately. Rollins said that of DeSantis. He said he's not a people person and not open to changing. He even ridiculed DeSantis for laying off campaign staff as he was stepping up his Iowa campaign. Rollins said the job you're running for is all about management. And, you know, that's something, when you do that on the eve of when you're really going into Iowa in a big way, that it should have really just been done much more quietly, without the fanfare of a reboot, you know, making it part of the reboot. So DeSantis himself sort of shined a light on his problems. It does seem like DeSantis has been reduced to something of a caricature now, you know, first by Trump, you know, de-sanctimonious, and now by voters who have sort of taken a longish look at the Florida governor, and they've come away unconvinced. His only hope seems to be that with Trump collecting serious you know, democracy shaking criminal indictments, the way some people collect parking tickets, Republican voters will have an epiphany and realize he's doomed as a presidential candidate again. Maybe DeSantis then can get a second look, but that's going to have to come fast because, you know, even with the reboot and the belt tightening on staff, DeSantis will run until the money dries up, and we'll see maybe the first signs of a drop off in his fundraising ability in the next Federal Elections Commission campaign finance filing on September 30th. We may, you know, he still seems to be pretty vigorous when it comes to campaign collecting, but that will be a much watched date when it comes to a little bit of a reckoning for DeSantis on the downturn here. Really, for DeSantis, it's been a summer without a lot of love.
Democracy shaking indictments, like some voters collect parking tickets. That's a great line there, John. You know, the Trump campaign is really trying to twist the knife here. They put out a memo just this morning mocking the reboot. I'm going to read a little bit of it here, get your take, John. This is from Susie Wiles and Chris Lacivita, who are leading Trump's campaign. And it's the title of the memo is "Ron DeSantis Reboot Comparisons to John McCain in 2008, Not Based in Reality." Obviously, there's been a lot of comparisons to McCain's campaign, which also struggled around this time in 2008 and shed staff and then kind of regrouped and went on to win the Republican nomination that year. And Wiles and Lacivita say that shouldn't be a model or something that people expect of DeSantis. They say, quote, "There is no value proposition to a DeSantis candidacy. New Coke fell flat after much fanfare, and studies showed that more people consumed it, the more they disliked it." Does that sound familiar? DeSantis's campaign is marred by idiocy. John McCain did not spend the opening week of his reboot explaining why his staff produced a video with Nazi imagery, which we haven't discussed, but that was another big stumble, and defending his comments that slavery provided some benefit to enslaved Americans, which we're going to discuss here in a minute, while attacking Black Republicans publicly in the process. John, they like to put out these mocking things of DeSantis, but doesn't it show, I mean, if they're still really going after him, that he is the guy that they view as the biggest threat?
Yeah, well, there is that. Yeah, he is still the only rival to Trump that's anywhere near double digits right now, it seems like. And that's a plus for DeSantis. He's still the tallest of the midgets that are standing next to Trump right now. So he's still a potential thorn in the side of Trump. And there is always the concern for the Trump campaign that indeed somehow Republicans coalesce behind the number two guy, who is DeSantis right now. So it's a badge of honor for DeSantis, but Trump can attack viciously, and he has been doing that. And that has really taken a lot of the shine off DeSantis from the get-go. And, DeSantis has done a lot to himself. We can go back to Zach, when you were watching his Twitter town hall, which back in May was so error plagued. And,
being a pretty good metaphor for the entire campaign here.
Yeah, exactly. Was that an ominous sign about where the campaign was headed? So, yeah, we'll see. But DeSantis can take some enthusiasm, I guess, from the idea that Trump is still targeting him out of this broad field of candidates right now. But maybe that's going to shift too somewhere along the way. Maybe Tim Scott becomes the next target.
Well, he'll know that he's doing well when he starts getting attacked. The tallest of the midgets. You're full of good one-liners today, John. But you better watch out. DeSantis, the Trump campaign might steal that one from you. They love to highlight when he wears his cowboy boots that have heels on them. Well, one of the reasons that DeSantis may be struggling is he keeps getting thrown off topic. Like this last week, when there was intense coverage of Florida's new Black History Standards, which talk about slaves receiving personal benefits from their enslavement. The standards have been widely criticized by everyone from Vice President Kamala Harris, who made two recent trips to Florida to jab at DeSantis, to Black Republicans like Tim Scott and Byron Donalds, to just recently in this Trump memo. Antonio, DeSantis is digging in and defending this. Is that wise?
Well, common sense would tell us it's not wise, but then again, denigrating life-saving COVID vaccines as jabs and wasn't prudent, and digging his heels into the fight with Walt Disney World proved costly, and table setting the banning of books on Billie Jean King or Roberto Clemente or Anne Frank also would seem like unnecessary self-inflicted wounds. Look, here's the thing about, there are a couple of things that are getting lost in this whole fight. One of them is that the standards in general got the okay from his fellow Republicans. It's just as Congressman Byron Donalds of Naples said, who's by the way, one of the more visible Black Republicans, like he said, he just wanted a couple of sentences adjusted. And that's the word he used, adjusted.
Really, it's just one sentence or one clause sentence, right. In the sentence. Like if you modified one clause in one sentence, you could just get over this.
Exactly. But now that doesn't sound like a rebuke or an attack, but it did. But that's how the governor responded. He said that Byron Donalds and others were basically, you know, parroting leftist arguments. You know, now people can disagree with Byron Donalds on issues, but the one thing I don't think I would ever call him is a mole for the radical left. So what this shows is it's not just about.
Although he is a big Trump supporter, and you could argue that he's, you know, trying to jab at DeSantis because of Trump.
But it wasn't much of a jab. He actually lauded the standards overall and just said, hey, there's just one sentence that just adjusted. I mean, that's not even much of an attack. I think what this shows again is that DeSantis demonstrating that he cannot tolerate even friendly, constructive criticism. In an interview this week, however, DeSantis said, quote, I don't believe in demeaning anybody. We really, well, you know, those high school kids that you scolded and berated because they wore COVID face coverings to one of your presses might disagree about that. But, you know, the other thing is, let's just take a second to think about what the governor is saying. You know, he's doubling down in defending a state educational standard that speaks to slavery as a benefit because it taught and provided experience in trade skills. You know, DeSantis is a governor in the party of Abraham Lincoln, and he's seeking the GOP presidential nomination that Lincoln won 163 years ago. You know, Lincoln is the POTUS that committed the Union to its most lethal war ever, precisely to end the expansion of slavery. Then Lincoln bucked his cabinet to push the Emancipation Proclamation to free slaves, and then pulled all sorts of political tricks to get Congress to ratify the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery. And now the governor, hoping to follow in Lincoln's footsteps, argues that slavery had some benefits. DeSantis might want to read the Lincoln-Douglas debates because, you know, if you're wondering why DeSantis' presidential stock has plummeted like a Wall Street crash, this helps explain it. You know, but in reality, a lot of this doesn't really, it's not really that surprising. You know, we've seen the governor take hardline position now for years and then become defensive and combative when he gets pushback. And that's not a departure. The one thing that did surprise me out of Florida this week is that Vice President Kamala Harris turned down the opportunity to debate the standards here in Florida. And we should talk a little bit about this because it seems to me there's a missed opportunity there for Harris to raise her profile on what seems like a fairly easy debate to win. My thinking is that, you know, there are concerns about Biden's age, and that means by extension, there are concerns about Harris herself. You know, this could be an opportunity for her to deck DeSantis, who we have seen is not a great debater, and to do it in his home state, and maybe energize dispirited Florida Democrats and maybe even stall the avalanche-like momentum that Florida Republicans have enjoyed for more than half a decade now. You know, I mean, if I were in a high school debate and the topic were slavery and I got to argue against slavery, you know, I'd take that challenge.
The only reason I could see is that maybe they just don't want to give him any oxygen because they want to run against Trump. But I mean, DeSantis' reaction, you're right, Antonio, is completely unsurprising. You know, Trump sort of perfected this playbook, never apologize for anything, never look weak, always double down, always punch back. And that's what DeSantis has adopted as well. He will never admit that he's wrong, because that is, seems like a weakness. But I wonder if they're, you know, if there's this whole idea that all publicity is good publicity. And if you're talking about DeSantis, maybe you're giving him free media attention. Is there, do you think there's any benefit of him getting embroiled in this fight, or do you think that it all kind of cuts against him? Because maybe for the MAGA base, maybe they want to see him fight over some of these issues. I mean, critical race theory, all of the racial stuff that has become such a big part of the Republican agenda, maybe this fits in somehow with all of that. I mean, it seems pretty clear to most people that there were no benefits from slavery, and DeSantis has tried to sort of equivocate and say that's not really what the standards are saying. But, you know, people who have read it on its face, who are Republicans, disagree with that. But I wonder, do you think that just the idea of him being in the news with what could help him with some base voters?
Well, you know, we got two cliches clashing into each other, you know, with each other. One is the, you know, you just pointed out that all news, you know, any news is good news because it gives you attention, it gives you oxygen, it gives you.
Yeah. And the reason I bring it up is because this seems like a pattern with DeSantis. This is how he kind of rose to prominence in the Republican Party, by picking all these fights that were very controversial. And a lot of people thought, well, man, I can't believe you're going there. But it ended up making him stronger within the Republican Party.
Yeah, but the other problem is it's crashed against the other cliche, which is if you're explaining, you ain't winning, which a colleague of ours on this podcast would repeatedly remind us. And he's just spending a lot of time explaining. And I'm not seeing this, you know, we'll see what the polls look like when the next set, they'll probably come out early, you know, in the next week or so. But I've not seen any of this move the needle. I have not seen the fight with Disney World move the needle for him. What did definitely move the needle for him was COVID, but that was because it wasn't so much. It was just that people were tired of the COVID restrictions. And I think that he correctly, we said this on this podcast, whether you agree with the way he did it or not, doesn't matter. He correctly read popular mood. Popular mood was, we're done with these restrictions. We don't want to sit in our house. We don't want to wear a mask in public 24/7, you know, and if I want to get a vaccine, it should be my decision. That was right or wrong. That was the public mood. He read it correctly. And I think he got rewarded for it in November of last year. But on these other cultural fights, the LGBTQ plus video that his campaign put out, that's another one where he ends up explaining and trying to rationalize it and justify it. And I'm not sure that's moving. It certainly hasn't moved the needle for him among the MAGA crowd and the hard right of the Republican Party.
You're saying the popular mood is that slavery wasn't beneficial? I think that that's
probably... I think we can judge that. I think we can conclude that, in fact, the popular mood believes that Lincoln was right and that the Confederacy was wrong.
I don't know. The world's changing. Who knows? All right. We'll move on to some numbers here. John, you want to tell us about yours?
Yeah, Zach, I had a 23, and it kind of recalls, you know, Michael Jordan made a career out of wearing 23. But, you know, Ron DeSantis, he'd like to get rid of his 23. It's the percentage of college graduates among Republican voters who support him. The problem is that in the same cohort, 40% support President Trump, former President Trump, the guy with the three criminal indictments. Those are the numbers from the New York Times Siena College poll that were released just before Trump's latest indictment. And those numbers are the poll numbers are getting a lot of attention over the course of this week. But, you know, for DeSantis, the telling thing is that he's not getting swamped by Trump among college graduates. It's that this group a month ago actually favored him over Trump, according to a CNN poll at that time. Remember, DeSantis was supposed to be the smarter, more sensible, less controversial version of Trump. And all the right-wing policies and the autocratic rage that you liked with Trump, you could get with DeSantis, but without the drama. Well, that argument has clearly fallen flat, and that's another part of the governor's repivot. It's perhaps no surprise that the same day that this poll came out, DeSantis was already unveiling an economic plan in early primary state New Hampshire that really played heavily into populist working class themes and also fed into a few conspiracies about everything from COVID to Amazon to the Federal Reserve and the World Economic Forum. It's really something that DeSantis clearly sees he needs at least a bigger portion of that blue collar voting base that is locked on to Trump and doesn't seem willing to let go. The college Republican crowd, the college educated Republican crowd, there's just not really enough of them, it seems like, right now to make that much of a difference for him right now. And that's, you know, going to be costly going forward. So, maybe DeSantis gets a second look somewhere along the way. The fact that, he is somebody that is still hanging around the edges of the Trump campaign. Will they again get cozier with the promise of a smarter, policy oriented Trump? But that doesn't seem to be there any longer. If he's lost the Chardonnay and charcuterie crowd, that was one of his last bastions of potential support. So this DeSantis island of support just seems to be getting smaller the longer he runs and the more money he spends.
Yeah, I did a story a few weeks ago, John, about how DeSantis is really struggling with blue collar voters, and now if he doesn't have white collar voters, what collar voter does he have? There was like the beer track vote that Trump was dominating, and DeSantis had the wine track vote, but now he's got to look for a different beverage group here. I don't know. That's bad news for him. How about you, Antonio?
My number is 33, and I'm going across the pond to the Spanish elections with a cautionary political tale for conservatives here. If you guys recall back in March, I talked about, political trends in Spain as these right-wing politicians were parroting both Trump and DeSantis rhetoric. One politician even said that her goal was to make Spain the Florida of Europe. Well, a funny thing happened when they actually went to count the votes in the July 23rd national elections in Spain. The Conservative Popular Party, which is Spain's version of the GOP, was expected to regain power because of the unpopularity of the ruling liberal government. But when the votes were counted, the Popular Party, which is kind of like the Republican Party, like I said, fell short of winning a majority of the seats in parliament. And here's the thing. It's not that the Popular Party underperformed. It's that the far-right Vox Party did extremely poorly. Think of it this way. Imagine if in the U.S. the Republicans were their own party and then the Trump faithful were their own separate party. And the way that they would ruin an election is they would form a coalition government. They would join forces. Well, that's what the expectation was. The expectation was that the Popular Party would win all these seats and Vox would win all these other seats, and then they would rule together. But here's what happened. Vox flopped in the July 23rd election. The MAGA-like Vox Party not only did not pick up seats, they lost more than a third of the existing seats, 19. So they ended up with just 33 seats, which is my number, where they previously had 52 seats. And here's the thing. And because of that failure of Vox, it basically has kept the Popular Party from becoming the ruling party in Spain. So here's the thing. We've seen the same trend kind of in Western Europe. In France, for example, unpopular French liberal leader Emmanuel Macron won re-election because he was opposed by a far-right candidate, Marie Le Pen, and voters said, you know what, we don't like Macron very much, but the far right is just a little bit way out there, so they went with Macron. And we actually saw a similar result here in the United States in last year's midterm election. The GOP, as you remember, was poised to ride a colossal red wave courtesy of President Joe Biden's unpopularity until GOP voters nominated a bunch of election-denying far-right Republican candidates. In the end, many of those candidates lost, and instead of winning the U.S. Senate, Republicans actually had a net loss of one seat as the Democrats emerged with that one seat gain. The GOP did win a House majority, but with a really slim advantage. So the moral of the story here is that in the Western democracies, from North America to Europe, voters have, when presented with an unpopular liberal leader or government and a far-right alternative, they seem to have sided with the unpopular liberal leader. So just something to keep in mind as we head into 2024, and it looks like, you know, Mr. Trump is that going to be at the head of the ticket for the Republican Party.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, the story in global politics over the last few years has really been the success of these far right populist movements. And they have had, you know, it's not just Trump winning. There's a far right leader in Italy right now. But your point to being that there's some backlash to this, and maybe the tide is starting to ebb a little bit. So we'll see. My number is 6. That's how many of the 42 billionaires who donated to DeSantis' reelection campaign through May of last year also donated directly to the Never Back Down PAC supporting the governor's presidential campaign. I did a story last year looking at DeSantis' billionaire donor support and found 42 of them, which is an expert told me was extraordinary in a governor's race. People I talked to said that having those billionaires in his corner could help DeSantis a lot when he runs for president. The problem is that most of them aren't cutting big checks to his presidential campaign, which actually I found a little bit surprising. I thought that a lot of them would transfer over, but Never Back Down released its first financial report this week, and only 6 of the 42 contributed directly to the PAC. Another 4 of those 42 billionaires gave to DeSantis's state political committee in February, which then transferred all of its money right in to Never Back Down. So that, you know, they basically kind of donated to his presidential campaign as well. But even then, it would only be 10 out of the 42, or less than 25%. Some of the 6 include like the DeVos family. Betsy DeVos was Trump's education secretary. They own the Orlando Magic, which got some attention this week for giving Never Back Down $50,000. Ed DiBartolo Jr., who's a Tampa businessman, also gave to Never Back Down and to DeSantis' state political committee. Norman Brahman, who's a well-known donor, a GOP donor in South Florida, gave to both. But some of DeSantis's biggest billionaire supporters from his governor's race last year haven't transferred over. Most notably, Ken Griffin, the hedge fund manager who gave DeSantis $5 million for his reelection campaign, has not given to his presidential campaign yet. So it's pretty fascinating that this billionaire support, which really seemed to buoy DeSantis and push him to record fundraising in his governor's race, and was one of those sort of one of those sort of check marks where people looked and said, man, this guy could be a big contender if he's got all these heavy hitter donors behind him. That really hasn't materialized. He does have some mega donors for his PAC, most notably Robert Bigelow, who put in $20 million and also gave $10 million to his reelection campaign last year. Bigelow he made his fortune on an extended stay motel company and also has an aerospace company, and notably said that in an interview that he thinks aliens are already here on Earth. He has continued to be DeSantis's biggest donor. He is not a billionaire, at least according to Forbes, so he wasn't on my list of 42, but he is standing behind DeSantis, and that's no small amount of money. But it isn't the big group of billionaires that maybe he would have hoped to have had to carry him down the stretch in this campaign. And that might be a sign that not only is he struggling to inspire the grassroots, but that big money donors who have helped make him a top tier candidate also are a little bit nonplussed by his campaign so far. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production guru, Thomas Cordy, and thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.